You are Locked On Seahawks, your daily Seattle Seahawks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Greetings 12, this is Corbin Smith, your host for Locked On Seahawks. Happy Labor Day to all of our listeners. Hope you found a way to get out there and have some fun today while staying safe. Now for your lead story here on Locked On Seahawks. The Jadeveon Clowney sweepstakes is over, but it didn't fall in Seattle's favor. After nearly 6 months of waiting and waiting to make a decision, the former number one overall pick agreed to terms with the Tennessee Titans on a one-year deal worth up to $15 million, $12 million base salary, $3 million in incentives, spurring the Seahawks and the New Orleans Saints. Various reports suggested the Seahawks were still very much in the hunt deep into Saturday night, though Diana Russini of ESPN indicated the team knew by Saturday morning that they weren't going to get him. Comments from Pete Carroll today indicated that they were very much involved up till the final moments trying to bring Clowney back. The price just wasn't right. Carroll had this to say: "We were involved throughout, but yet we moved on, you know, for the most part very early in the offseason so that we could get the rest of the team built. And fortunately, we were able to do that and got some good players." It's really a perplexing situation on numerous fronts. First, when you look at Jadeveon Clowney, he just replaced his agent a day or two before signing with the Titans. He fired his agent. He could have gotten this kind of money earlier in the offseason, including from the Seahawks. They made multiple offers to him, and at one point, one of those offers was a one-year deal for $15 million, and he rejected it. He just took a similar deal from the Titans here. I think that it reached a point where he decided, if I'm going to take significantly less than what I was asking for, I'm going to do it after I have not had to participate in training camp. He wanted to avoid getting an injury, catching the virus. I guess you can understand. He just was never able to get the money that he and his representatives thought he was going to going into free agency. He thought he was going to get $20 million more per year. And not only were the Seahawks not going to pay that price, but no other team was willing to pay that price as well. He just hasn't been an elite enough pass rusher since coming into the NFL. He's never had double-digit sacks. He had just 3 sacks for the Seahawks last year. I believe he was much more disruptive than those numbers indicate. He had a really good pass rush win rate per ESPN, one of the best in the league in that category. So I think he was a much better pass rusher than his sack numbers indicate. That being said, teams pay for sacks, and when you're a player that has the injury history that Clowney does, especially since he had microfracture surgery on his knee during the early stages of his time with the Texans after he was drafted number one overall, teams just aren't comfortable handing out long-term deals for $19-20+ million per year. If he had the sack numbers, then certainly that would have changed things. But ultimately, from Seattle's standpoint, throwing a two-year $27 million deal at him early in free agency, that showed they didn't value him as people thought they would. A longer-term deal would have certainly had more money per year, but they were not going to approach that $20 million per year threshold that Clowney thought he was going to get in free agency. And unless the Seahawks were the ones that were going to overpay there, which Snyder was not going to do, he was going to hit the market regardless. So those out there that believe the Seahawks could get him signed before free agency, I think it would have taken a deal of $21, $22 million per year, which, as we've seen in the past, John Snyder is just not going to pay the perceived market price for top-tier defensive ends, especially a player like Clowney that hasn't had the sack numbers. 2 years ago, Frank Clark had 13.5 sacks, and the Seahawks didn't want to pay him, and so they traded him to the Chiefs. That's just a position group that it is now very clear that Snyder, the front office, the coaching staff, everybody in the Seahawks organization, they value pass rushers, but they are not going to pay that premium price. They will pay safeties, they will pay corners, they will pay linebackers, but defensive linemen in general, they are always looking for bargains at that position. They will pay top 10 price for a defensive end. We saw him do that with Michael Bennett a few times, but they are never going to pay a defensive end as the number one or number two, unless it's somebody that's just clearly the number one pass rusher in the entire league. Maybe then John Snyder would consider it, but that's just not where they've prioritized paying players in the past, and it looks like that trend is going to continue. Just not going to pay that market price for a defensive lineman. Never done it for tackles, never done it for ends, not going to pay that top dollar. So you got to wonder now, looking back, the decision not to pay Clark. It now looks a lot more questionable because they brought in Clowney a few months later. They traded for him at the end of training camp, right before the start of the regular season, and they were in a position where they couldn't negotiate a long-term deal with him until the year was over with, but there was still a lot of confidence that the Seahawks were going to re-sign him, and now here we are, 6 months after free agency started, he has signed with the Titans. Clark is now in Kansas City. There are plenty of question marks in that defensive line, and by the way, with Clowney, they finished second to last in the NFL in sacks. And so those questions, those concerns are certainly warranted. Pete Carroll is far more optimistic about that pass rushing group than most people are. Going to be very fascinating to see what that group looks like when they finally take the field on Sunday against the Atlanta Falcons. Coming up next, it's time for a Labor Day edition of our Monday mailbag. I will be answering questions from you, the listeners. Don't go away. You're listening to the Locked On Seahawks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. This season, get football on your time with NFL Game Pass. You can catch every snap from every game with full game replays and see all the plays in just 45 minutes with condensed games. You can relive all the gutsy calls, crazy catches, wild comebacks, and breakout stars from every game every week. It's all the action, all the football you can handle, all in one place. And NFL Game Pass is the only place you can replay every game all season long. You'll also learn from the league's best players with over 40 NFL Game Pass film session episodes. Go inside the game from a player's perspective as they break down the game's concepts and techniques. Learn from the best like Deshaun Watson, Stephon Gilmore, Devontae Adams, and many more. NFL Game Pass also provides access to the entire NFL Films archive. Go to NFL.com/Game Pass to start your free trial today. NFL Game Pass, where football never stops. Welcome back to the Locked On Seahawks podcast. I'm your host, Corbin Smith. It's time for our Monday mailbag segment, Labor Day edition. Tons of questions from you, the 12, so let's get to it. First one coming from Dominic Tweets. What's your over-under for sack total this season? I'm thinking somewhere in the 35 to 40 range. Improved from last year, but not quite in the really good category. Well, I will say this, Dominic. If the Seahawks can get to 35 to 40 sacks this year with the secondary pieces that they now have and they have a higher pressure rate, I think Pete Carroll and Ken Norton Jr. will be jumping for joy. I don't think the Seahawks need to have a top five pass rushing unit. They do not need to finish in the top five in sacks. If they do, that's a fantastic development. They just can't afford to be as inept at it as they were last year. I think if this pass rush is a middle-of-the-pack unit that can get you 34, 35 sacks, they've got a little higher pressure rate than what they had last year, more quarterback hits, just in general, more disruptive getting after the opposing quarterback with the addition of Jamal Adams, with the addition of Quentin Dunbar. He's still got to beat out Trey Flowers, but I believe he will be in the starting lineup at some point, if not this upcoming weekend in Atlanta. You've got two additions there in the secondary that should make that unit much better. Quandre Diggs, you have him now for an entire season at free safety, and Shaquille Griffin was a Pro Bowler last year. And everybody knows how good the linebacking group is with Bobby Wagner, KJ Wright, Bruce Irvin, Jordan Brooks, the first-round pick, is going to be fighting for playing time very quickly. So if you were able to just get mid-level production rushing the passer from that front four and you don't have to rely on the blitz too much, especially with Adams, a player that's very good at that, but from what Pete Carroll said today, that's not something they want to do unless they have to very much. They'll send him some, but they want that front four to be disruptive and be able to get to the quarterback so they can run what they want to run in coverage. If they are able to do that and be in the middle of the pack, that is a dramatic improvement from last year, and that's really going to help this defense at all three levels. So I think that 35-40 range, that might be doable with the group they've got there, especially with some of the speedier ends they've brought into the picture with Benson Maiyoua. Irvin's going to get some reps over there. Eventually, Daryl Taylor. Alton Robinson is a guy that runs in the 4.6, is a pretty good athlete as well. So they are more athletic there than what they have been the last couple of seasons. Now, is the production going to translate? Second question from Keith Kettover tweets, how can we convince Pete Carroll to let Puna Ford take snaps at fullback instead of keeping Nick Ballore around? Well, this question was actually asked about 20 minutes before news broke that the Seahawks had re-signed Nick Ballore. So I don't know that I'm going to be able to convince Coach Carroll to make that move since they just brought Ballor back. But I have talked to Puna Ford about this before. 12s, if you have not seen it, at least it was on YouTube. There were highlight clips of Puna Ford in high school, and he actually ran the football some for his high school team. And can you imagine trying to tackle Puna Ford? Now he's 5'10", 5'11", 300 pounds. He's a big dude, but really athletic, really quick for his size. And he used to just bowl over people. He was a great lead blocker as well. So I actually asked him about that his rookie season when they had some injuries at the fullback position. If he had been approached by the coaching staff about moving there, he smiled and said that hadn't happened. But he is certainly a guy that if they had a situation where they needed a short yardage blocker and they didn't have a fullback, if it's a 1 or 2 yard situation, I'd put Puna in there and let him block for any running back. I think he would do a good job. It would be fun to watch, but I recommend if you can find it. I don't know if it's still on YouTube, but there used to be highlights of Puna Ford from high school. You can search on Google maybe and find him too, but he played on both sides of the ball. It was a lot of fun to watch. William Bryan tweets, it's been mentioned that the Seahawks are perhaps copying the New England Patriots coverage over rush spending. I can buy that, but overspending for backup linemen and middle-of-the-road pass rushers, how is that defensible? So I don't know necessarily that they're trying to copy the Patriots blueprint. I think the Seahawks are going to still do things a lot of the same ways that they have throughout Pete Carroll's tenure there in Seattle. But I don't even know if I would say that they've been overspending for backup linemen and middle-of-the-road pass rushers. I mean, Bruce Irvin has had 3 different years of 8-plus sacks. He's never been a double-digit guy, but if you're able to get similar production to that with what he brings to the table playing Sam linebacker, Carroll has said he's the best player he's ever had at that position, and you're paying him $6 million for a year, I think it's well worth the cost. And Benson Maioa is around $3 million, and he had a career high in sacks last year. He's a player that's been ascending the last few years. He's only 28 years old. He might just be entering the prime of his career. He was a late bloomer coming out of Idaho. And then you got a couple of rookies that have a chance to really contribute. I still think down the road, he's going to miss the first 6 weeks, but I think Daryl Taylor will have a chance to be a guy in the second half of the season that could really make an impact for this team. And Alton Robinson's going to make an impact right away. The fifth rounder's been impressive throughout camp. So I don't think they've overspent for backup linemen, middle-of-the-road pass rushers. I think that they just got quality guys that were in that third tier that they could sign to one-year deals that know their system. So I think it is defensible. Now, if you want to make the counter-argument, they could have spent a couple more million dollars to try to get Jadeveon Clowney. I'm all on board with that. This defensive line would have been better with him, but it was clearly evident that the Seahawks at this point had a price and they weren't willing to go above it. They like the group that they've got, and I'm higher in this group than most people are. I don't know that's necessarily going to be a ton better, but I think at least from a pass rushing perspective, bringing in players like Irvin and Maioa, I think those guys are going to end up being really nice bargains for them, especially Maioa, who has a chance to start at that Leo position in week one. James Davis tweets, could the Seahawks be expecting to just play Brian Monet as a replacement for Al Woods? How much of a difference would that be in skill set? Well, they're both big-bodied guys. Right now, Brian Monet is in the 340-pound range. Last year, he weighed 355, 360. He's just a big dude. He is a bigger guy than Al Woods. That being said, I think Al Woods is obviously a much more refined football player. Brian Monet was pretty raw coming out of Michigan. He was an undrafted rookie. He got to play in 4 games last year. I think he's had a pretty solid camp. I don't think he's got the same quick first step. Not saying that Al Woods has an explosive first step necessarily, but for a guy of his size, moves pretty well. I don't know that Brian Monet is able to, it has the same quick first step that what he has. But I think what he does offer you, he is a big body that's very difficult to move in space. And he showed last year in a couple games that he played that he is capable of getting tackles in the backfield. This is a guy that isn't just a space eater. Not that he's going to rack up tackles the way Brandon Mebane and some of Seattle's best nose tackles have done in the past, but I think he's certainly a guy that provides a little bit of ability to make plays at the line of scrimmage, get in the backfield occasionally. You're not going to get any pass rush from him. Even Al Woods last year did that a little bit. So I think there's a drop-off there, but certainly this is a young guy that Coach Carroll and Clint Hurt, those guys are fired up about Brian Monet, and there's a reason right now he is the third defensive tackle on the depth chart. He's earned that. We'll see how big of a drop-off it is from Al Woods on the field, though. He was pretty important for them last season. A lot of people are arguing they haven't found a replacement to this point. We'll just have to see how it plays out. Patrick Keane tweets, with the report of a sign-and-trade attempt by the Saints to land Clowney that was nixed by the NFL, do you think allowance of that type of transaction could be part of the next CBA? Well, it could be. That's going to be a long time from now. This new CBA goes through 2030, and obviously they can make revisions occasionally when you have things like the coronavirus happen. They had to make some modifications before they started this season because they had never played through a health crisis like this. So obviously things like that, and you can have some revisions made. But I don't know this is something the NFL is ever necessarily going to be on board with. They like having the hard salary cap that they've had for the last 20, 30 years. They don't want to make adaptations to this. And this makes it easier for the rich to get richer and the poor to become poorer. If teams realize, hey, I can do sign-and-trades, and this team that was really bad last year, but they have tons of cap space, they can chew up some of that cap space. We give them a mid-round pick, and now we have a superstar on our roster. They don't want to do things that way. So me personally, I think it would really spice up the offseason. It would spice up training camp. I think you'd see a lot of really cool moves that were made by teams. But at the same time, I don't think this is something that the NFL is necessarily going to embrace. Thomas Trevison tweets, do you think LJ Collier has a possible brighter future in the NFL as a full-time defensive tackle than a defensive end? I really need to see how this year plays out because I've been encouraged from what I've seen of him playing the five-tech defensive end position, but I also have made arguments already this offseason. He's over 290 pounds. He's a big dude. He is not a great athlete for the defensive end position, but you reduce him inside at his 290-pound frame, he is a plus athlete for the three-tech defensive tackle position. He plays with heavy hands. I think he could play there on early downs if necessary. I don't know right now that he is an every-down defensive tackle. He'd probably have to get up to around 300 pounds to be able to do that. But he is certainly a great athlete at that particular position, and I think he would be more of a factor as a pass rusher from the interior as well. I expect this year we're going to see a lot of him playing that three-tech role reduced inside, and it might be more than just your obvious third-down situations. I think they're going to find a lot of ways to get him on the field, whether he's playing five-tech or three-tech. He's going to get a lot of snaps, a great chance for him to rebound from a really tough rookie year. And if he plays really well at that defensive tackle position, they continue to get growth from Rasheem Green, some of the rookie ends play well, then suddenly the Seahawks might approach him next year and say, we're just going to make you a starter on the inside. It's very possible that that could be something they do down the road. But I don't think they're ready to give up on him playing that Quentin Jefferson role where he plays both spots. Garrett Kirby tweets, who's your bet to be the surprise star for the season? Well, at this point, it's not a surprise because any reporter that has been at training camp knows what Marquise Blair has done playing that slot cornerback position. But I just want to, again, go through this. You know, when they traded for Jamal Adams, that put a huge roadblock in front of Blair for him to get on the field. He already had Quandre Diggs at free safety, who was cemented in as a starter. Now you've got Jamal Adams, who you traded two first-round picks for. There's no room for him on the field, and yet he's been able to make that really quick transition to that slot corner position, and he's got surprising quickness for a player of his size. Was a sub-7-second three-cone drill coming out of Utah. And he's physical at the point of attack, as everybody knows. He's shown way better ball skills than I anticipated with a bunch of interceptions during training camp and in their mock games. And you know he's going to be able to come up and stick people. He's a really effective blitzer there. I just think he creates so many more options for Ken Norton Jr. on that defense. And I think just from his presence alone, getting that three safety look out there, that you are going to see a lot more nickel packages this year. The base defense will still be used quite a bit because of their linebacker depth, but I don't even know if I'd call him a surprise star at this point just because of the way that the training camp and stuff has gone. But he is a guy that I think going into camp, everybody was kind of like, well, he might get a few snaps at nickel corner. I think he is going to be an integral part of this defense in 2020. Last question real quick. Jaden tweets, what kind of player are we getting in DeAndre Walker? 6'2", 251 pounds. As Pete Carroll mentioned today, I actually asked him about their decision to claim Walker off waivers because he did not play any snaps last year, not even in the preseason. He was placed in injured reserve for the Titans on August 10th, and he was a fifth-round pick for them out of Georgia. His last 2 years with the Bulldogs, he had 13 sacks, 5 forced fumbles. He is not a super twitchy athlete. He's not a guy that's going to blow past people off the edge. That is not his game. But He plays physical for 251 pounds. He plays with heavy hands. He's got a decent array of counter moves. I still think there's a lot of room to develop in that regard, but he was an effective pass rusher because of his technique and his physicality at Georgia. And so I think he's going to get a look at the Sam linebacker position as well as Leo. They're going to use him in that Bruce Irvin type role where he can play a little bit of both because of his size. He's athletic enough that you can play him at both those spots as well. And so this is just going to kind of be one of those situations where they really liked him coming out of Georgia. They had the college film to work with. And so they take a gamble here, roll the dice a little bit and see what you have in this guy. And a few weeks in, they might decide, you know what, this guy's not panning out. They'll move on. Or it might quickly become apparent, what were the Titans thinking? We made a huge decision here, and he can end up stepping in and playing for you. That would not surprise me. There's a lot of traits he brings to the table that the Seahawks are always looking for, especially at that Leo position. Maybe not the twitchiest, most athletic edge rusher, but he certainly has a lot of other traits that they like to have over there. And he checks off the versatility card nicely for the Seahawks. When we come back for the third quarter, the 53-man roster has officially been set for the Seahawks. There's been a few moves already made the last 24 hours after the initial roster. I'll go through some of the biggest surprises for Seattle's 53-man roster, positions I'm really excited about, and the ones that I'm maybe still a little bit concerned about heading into week one. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Locked On Seahawks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. As an avid weightlifter and distance runner, I'm always looking for an edge when it comes to nutrition, seeking delicious, healthy protein bars without the crazy additives. Since being diagnosed with celiac disease, my options have been pretty limited. Until now. Enter in the Built Bar, a low-calorie, low-sugar, high-protein, gluten-free protein bar that tastes like a candy bar. Built Bar now comes in 18 mouth-watering flavors, including 6 new delicious flavors such as caramel brownie and cookies and cream. My all-time favorite is peanut butter brownie, which is 20 grams of protein, just 3 grams of sugar, and 3 grams of net carbs. Since I had my first Built Bar, I never go without one when I hit the weight room or go for a jog. All Built Bars are 100% chocolate, nut and gluten-free, soft and easy to chew, and don't have the nasty aftertaste of competing protein bars. Sound too good to be true? Go to BuiltBar.com and build your own custom box with your choice of flavors using the code LOCKEDON for $10 off. You will also receive a free cooler with your first purchase while supplies last. So what are you waiting for? Change your workout game by going to BuiltBar.com and entering code LOCKEDON for $10 off. Welcome back to the Locked On Seahawks podcast. I'm your host, Corbin Smith. The Seahawks and the rest of the NFL have officially set their 53-man rosters. The deadline was at 1 p.m. Pacific time on Saturday. This was a little different year than normal. In a lot of ways, it was just your typical cut-down day. There's always those handful of players that throughout the entire process, it looked unlikely that they were going to make the team. And then, of course, you had your bubble players, maybe 10, 12 guys that were competing for 4 or 5 spots at the end of the roster. And there's always the questions about contracts, age versus experience. It's not always about just talent. If it was just the most talented 53-man roster that you could assemble, every team would have a couple positions where they had a surplus, and they'd have some positions where only 1 or 2 guys would make the roster. And that's just not how it works in the NFL. So again, in a lot of ways, very similar to what we're used to in late August, early September. But then there was the whole fact there was no preseason games, and that really complicated trying to evaluate players from other teams. The Seahawks and a bunch of other teams, they like to scout other games and look at players that maybe won't make other teams that would make the Seahawks roster, that would be upgraded to a certain position. And this year, that was complicated by the fact that you had over 100 preseason games that did not happen. So you didn't have the game film to evaluate. The scouting department, it was up to them to go back and look at college tape. Or if it's a player that's been in the league for a couple years, maybe you can find some preseason games from their rookie season. So it was just much more difficult to be able to evaluate players like DeAndre Walker, who they ended up claiming off waivers from the Titans because they had tons of college tape on him from Georgia. They had a top 30 visit with him going into the 2019 draft. Those were the types of players that teams were claiming off waivers, but only 17 players total around the entire NFL were claimed off waivers. That illustrates just how tough it was for teams to be able to evaluate players from other teams. And that's the other reason the Seahawks were able to keep a bunch of their own players in the practice squad. Normally, it's 50-50, maybe five players from their training camp or on the practice squad, five players from other teams. This year, 15 of the 16 players on the practice squad spent training camp with the Seahawks. And the big reason for that is everybody was clearing through waivers this year. And so the Seahawks are excited about that. Probably a little disappointed they couldn't get a closer look at what other teams had on their roster because of the complications amid COVID-19. As far as surprises with the 53-man roster, there weren't too many, to be honest with you. Most of the things that happened, I anticipated. And if it was a player that I didn't pick to make my 53-man roster, like, say, Luke Wilson, I wasn't surprised that Luke Wilson made the team. I thought they would maybe go with a younger player in Stephon Sullivan. They were able to cut him and get him to the practice squad. So he's still under contract with the team. They're hoping that Stephon Sullivan can be a big-time contributor for them down the road, but they went with the reliability and experience in Luke Wilson. I'm not surprised by that. Really, the only move that shocked me was the decision to waive Shaquem Griffin, because everybody knows what kind of speed he brings to the table. And this is not just about him being a great story. If that's all this was about, the NFL was a business. And unfortunately, you want the best roster you can put together. If he was not deserving of being on that roster from a playing standpoint, then it's completely understandable. And you're not going to let the fact his twin brother's on the team entering a contract year impact that either. But being at most of the training camp practices, I thought Shaquem Griffin had a fantastic camp, and he was spending a lot of time working with Bruce Irvin. They were spending time with defensive line, working on pass rushing stuff. He was spending time in linebacker drills, working at the Sam linebacker spot. Ken Norton Jr. said he was the main backup just a week ago to Bruce Irvin. So I thought not only was he on the roster, I thought he was safe. I didn't even think that he was on the fringe. There were other beat reporters that thought that he was on the bubble. From what I had seen at camp, I thought that he was a clear-cut, cemented on-the-roster pick. I didn't see any way he was going to get cut. So I was very surprised. I get that they have tons of depth at linebacker. I'll get into that more here in a moment. But with his ability to rush off the edge, sub-4.4 speed, and how well he played in the second half last year, the way coaches have been talking him up, I just was stunned. But they were able to get him on the practice squad. He slipped through waivers just like almost everybody else did, and they were able to re-sign him on the practice squad. I would anticipate that Griffin is back on the 53 very quickly, whether there's an injury or they just decide to bring him back up. I just think he played too well in camp, and I think eventually they're going to realize, why do we even do that? I think he needs to be on the 53-man roster. We'll see what happens, but that was certainly the one big shocker for me based on what I had seen at camp. I would have said quarterback Lyndon Stevens also was a surprise because he initially made the team, but less than 24 hours later, he was cut, and now he's back on the practice squad. So that's about what I anticipated with him. I thought he might be a candidate to be on that 16-player practice squad. I didn't think that he did enough in training camp to justify a roster spot, especially because he's been mostly playing on the outside, and he's a smaller corner, hasn't been doing much work in the slot. So that was another one that surprised me, but he's on the practice squad now, and so everything is lining up. As far as positions I'm excited about, looking at this 53-man roster, some of these are going to be obvious and some not so much. Maybe on the not so obvious, because they've signed Paul Richardson, who got cut a few days ago, only lasted a few days back with the team in his second stint. They added Josh Gordon. I think there's been a lot of questions about Seattle's receiving core, but I really like this group. Not just the fact that you've got two studs at the top in Tyler Lockett and DK Metcalf, but your number three receiver, Philip Dorsett, looks like he's feeling a lot better. He was dealing with a sore foot. He's running fast. He and Russell Wilson looked in sync for a good portion of training camp. And with his speed, his downfield capabilities, this is a perfect offense for him. And David Moore, he had a slow start at camp, but I thought he really finished strong. You know what you're going to get in David Moore out on the field. He's been inconsistent, but he's a downfield threat. I think they could use him more as a guy that you can get the ball out to quick on screens, slants, and let him make plays with the football in his hands. He can break tackles and create yardage after the catch. I think they'll find ways to continue to unlock that with him, especially after he restructured his deal to help open up a little bit more cap space. So I like those two as the 3 and 4 receivers, and if Gordon gets reinstated, then you've got a really interesting battle there for snaps behind Metcalf, and Lockett. And then you've got two young players to close out the depth chart. John Ursua had a really good camp. Such a slick route runner out of the slot. He's sneaky fast. He's a player with high football IQ. Last year, he was struggling to adjust to a pro-style offense, but he has really turned the corner this year. And Freddie Swain was really impressive. The sixth-round pick out of Florida. He even missed a couple practices dealing with a groin injury. He came back and just hit the ground running. He had a fantastic camp running out of the slot. He played some on the outside. He can return kicks. So those are two promising young players at the end of the depth chart that are going to be battling for playing time as well. Russell Wilson has no shortage of weapons in that receiving core, and if Gordon's reinstated, it just gets better. And then on defense, this is self-explanatory, Shaquem Griffin getting cut. It's because the linebacker group is insane. It is the most talented, it is the deepest linebacker group in the NFL. Your starting lineup, Bobby Wagner, KJ Wright, and Bruce Irvin. You have so much experience and so much talent in that group and flexibility with Irvin. You can move him up to the Leo position, and that's where rookie Jordan Brooks comes into play. I thought the first couple weeks of training camp that he looked a little bit over his head, and you can understand why. There were no OTAs or mini camps. Even your top profile first round picks, it is going to take time adjusting to playing at the highest level, but the light switch has really turned on the last week and a half or so, and he's been making a lot of plays out in the field. It just looks like he's playing faster. He's much more comfortable. He is going to be gunning for playing time sooner rather than later. And so does that mean he replaces Bruce Irvin at some point and Irvin gets more reps at Leo? I don't know how this is going to play out. It's a really good problem to have. But Brooks is knocking on the door right now. The rookie wants to play. The Seahawks want to get him out there. They're not going to force the issue, but he's coming. And the rest of the linebackers, the rest of the veterans, they know that. And then behind those guys, you've got Cody Barton and Ben Burke-Irvin, who both had really solid training camps. And I'm not lying when I say this. Those two guys, at least for Barton, you could say Barton could probably start for 10 to 15 teams in the NFL. And I think a handful of teams, Ben Burke-Irvin could be in a competition to start for them. That's how much depth the Seahawks have. Right now, those two are going to mainly be playing special teams if they get any snaps on defense because there's so much talent in front of them. And that's one reason Shaquem Griffin is a player that ended up getting waived because there's just so many bodies there. I thought they'd keep all seven linebackers. They chose to keep six instead with Ben Burke-Irvin beating out Griffin. But it's just such a talented group that sometimes you see that every team's got position groups like that where you have really good players that on a lot of other teams would make the team, but they're not good enough to make this particular one. Linebacker is the most loaded position for the Seahawks. Not far behind, in my opinion, is the safety spot. I talked about this a little bit in the second quarter with Marquise Blair playing that nickel corner position. He's going to be on the field a lot as that big nickel. They're going to have a three-headed monster with Quandre Diggs, Jamal Adams, and Marquise Blair. I think you're going to see that trio out on the field a lot. Maybe it's not 40 or 50%, but they are going to play a lot of three safety sets. You've got three different style players that all play a physical brand of football. You got a ball hawk in Quandre Diggs. You have a rare blitzing machine in Jamal Adams that is sound against the run. He's underrated in coverage. And Marquise Blair is probably the nastiest of the three. He'll just come up and nail you. He's always been a big hitter, plays the game with fire and tenacity. The Seahawks want to get him on the field. So I think you're going to see a lot of those three safeties on the field together, and it's going to create a lot of flexibility for Ken Norton Jr. as he tries to attack the complicated offenses that you see in the NFC West. As far as positions that I'm concerned about, there are two that really jump out, and it'll surprise people. I'm not going to list defensive end as one of the positions I'm necessarily concerned about. I would say it's middle of the road because I do think that Benson Maioa and Bruce Irvin and maybe Alton Robinson on day one, you have a lot more athleticism off the edge than this team had last year when they went out and got just 28 sacks as a team. I think that you're going to see a bounce back performance from Jaron Reed rushing the passer, but that's what leads me to one of my concerning positions. It is the defensive tackle spot. I gave a C+ on my positional grades in an article yesterday, and a lot of people are saying I was too polite. They're like, that's too high of a grade, but this is my viewpoint. Jaron Reed 2 years ago was playing at a Pro Bowl level. He had 10.5 sacks. I don't know that he can come close to replicating that again, but I don't think he is going to play as poorly as he did at times last year. I think you're going to see him come back and bounce back for the Seahawks this year. And I think Puna Ford is going to have a breakout season. You started to see glimpses of him becoming a much better pass rusher late in his first year as a starter a year ago, and it's really shown up on the practice field. I think he's going to have a really big third season. So I like the starters there. The problem is the depth. If Brian Monet plays really well, Pete Carroll's excited about his progress, then certainly that is going to help this team, especially from a run defense standpoint. But those are your three defensive tackles. They have no other guys on the roster. I thought by this point that they would have signed somebody like a Damon Harrison or a Marcel Darius, and both those guys are still available. They have not signed with anybody. Who knows if they want to play right now? They might be opting out for this season, but they're still available. There are a couple other solid veterans that have not been signed either, and yet the Seahawks have not done that. They only have three true defensive tackles on the roster. To me, this is the biggest area of weakness on this football team. I like the two starters, but they can't play 100% of the snaps. They need to add another veteran to that group to bolster the depth in the interior of their defensive line. And the other spot that concerns me still, I know Pete Carroll today indicated that Ethan Posick had sports hernia surgery. He took care of an issue that's been bothering him for a couple of years. He's playing at a much higher level than he has over the past few seasons. As a result, he has certainly outplayed BJ Finney. He deserves to be the starting center. Maybe there's a little more room for optimism there, but we have not seen Ethan Posick play consistently when he's had opportunities in the NFL and he's had durability issues. And the fact that BJ Finney got that $8 million contract and he came in and really, it was never a competition. Ethan Posick from day one had this one locked up. Regardless of what Carroll said, it was not a real competition. Posick had this one. They've brought in Justin Britt for a couple of visits, so they're looking at their former starter, maybe bringing him back. It just seems to me like, even with what Carroll said today, maybe you're a little more optimistic, but there are still concerns. They are not necessarily pleased with that position group. I like where the rest of the offensive line is heading. Damian Lewis has looked great at right guard. He's ready to start day one. Brandon Shell, he fits Seattle's offense. He has surprised me a little bit better than I even thought he was going to be in his first camp with the Seahawks. And on the left side, you got two reliable veteran starters in Duane Brown and Mike Iupati. But the big question mark is that center position that is so important, because the center manages all the communication, all the line calls, picking up blitzes, you name it. Ethan Posick is familiar with the system. He's got that working for him. But I have to see him go out there and play well in a few starts. If he does that, then maybe this isn't near as big of a concern. But if there's an area on that offensive line right now that would be a red flag for me, it would certainly be at center. Make sure to follow me on Twitter at CorbinSmithNFL. You can subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, whatever your preferred podcast platform is, by visiting our website, LockedOnSeahawks.com. Coming up on Tuesday, I'll be rejoined by Rob Rang, and we'll take a look back at last year's battle against the Falcons and a quick peek at what's new in Atlanta as we begin to preview Week 1. Enjoy the rest of your Labor Day. Go Hawks!